That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Been trying to set up our next guest for a while now, and this timing works out perfectly. He's got a movie to promote, and he's got a little bit of free time as he awaits the birth of his child, his third child, who is due any moment. So midway through, he may have to run off. But I've been wanting to have Ike Barinholtz on for a while, and we actually know each other sort of through our dads. And when I was moving out to LA right after college, my dad said, oh, this guy I know, his son is out there doing some comedy. You guys should connect. And I'm going to ask Ike, but I don't think we ever actually did meet. I think we just exchanged a bunch of emails and then became social media friends. There is a possibility that we met once at one of his shows, but I'm trying to see if he can help us rack our brains to see way back in the early or mid-2000s, if we ever made it happen. But I love his work. I think he's hilarious, and he's managed to work with some of my very, very favorite people in the industry. So I'm so excited to chat with him about his career and how he's been blown up of late. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview with Ike Barinholtz.
That's what she said.
You know him from Mad TV, Eastbound and Down, The Mindy Project, Neighbors, Suicide Squad, Sisters, and the new movie Blockers, which is coming out very soon. Ike Barinholtz, so happy to welcome you to the podcast. Thanks for making some time for me.
Thank you. And just hearing those movies, there's a lot of things that end in ers. Neighbors, Sisters, Blockers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
I just never noticed that until you said it.
Well, I'm glad it can bring your whole career all together for you.
Thank you.
Big moment. Before the pod, I opened up my Hotmail account, which I had not opened in years, which was actually fortuitous because I had an email about a TV request for like this week. And I'm like, who thinks I still use my Hotmail? But anyway,
wow.
I was going back to find
out. At least you don't have to even reply to it if they sent you a Hotmail.
No, right. I'm like, what year do you need this request for? 1998? But I found an old email between us when I was trying to figure out, did we ever actually meet once at a comedy improv spot on Hollywood Boulevard?
I feel like we met at IO West.
Yes.
Just recently closed a couple weeks ago. But I feel like that's the first time we met because of the paternal connection.
Yes. So my dad, when I moved to LA, was like, hey, this other lawyer I know has a son out there. He's doing comedy. You should hook up with him. So we exchanged a variety of emails and potentially MySpace messages. And then we met once very briefly, but that was it. But I was laughing
that
at
was
the
it.
Old, the old exchanges that we had where I was like, your friend Dave, I'm supposed to meet him because your dad told my dad that he's in sports and that you were like, Dave, yeah, he works with Jim Rome. And I'm like, I'm working at Jim Rome's studio right now. I met Dave. And it was just like so silly. And now Dave,
it's
of course,
crazy.
Is like your writing partner and super famous too.
David Sasson, he's on Twitter, and nothing would be more important to him than if you followed him to read about the incredibly boring, mundane things he does every day.
I think I already do follow him because I saw Mindy Kaling tweeting him enough. And as you know, I'm deeply obsessed with Mindy. So anyone that she takes the time to message, I'm like, I must know this person. But it's all coming full circle now.
I think she takes too much time with Dave's bullshit.
You're just jelly, I think, maybe.
I am. I am a little jelly.
Okay, so the reason our dads know each other is because you are from the Chicago area. You went to Latin High School. What kind of kid were you? Were you a goofball?
Cool. I was a goofball. I was. That's like a perfect word. I started off at a smaller school for elementary school right by Wrigley Field on Shamit, just a small Jewish school right across from the IHOP where I would see all the Cubs of my youth go there.
Nice.
Like you would walk in, you would see like Jerome Walton there putting down a short stack. It was awesome. but I was a goofball. Yeah, I was like a bad student. My teachers really liked me, but I was a bad student and, you know, just distracted and wanted just to, you know, watch movies and watch the Bulls. You know what I mean? But I think goofball is it's the only time I would use that word to describe me as a kid.
So right now, if you were a student, you would be getting pumped full of ADHD drugs when, in fact, all that had to do was foster your artistic urges.
Probably. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know about the ADHD drugs because I wasn't like – my mind wasn't racing. I was just kind of like – I just would like, I don't know, tell my parents like I was doing homework, but I'd really just like watch Trading Places. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You know what I mean? Like I wasn't like – I mean, but they probably would have. They probably would have given me some medication.
Yeah. So,
but we didn't have medication back then. We had teachers that smoked cigarettes in the class. You know what I mean?
That's true.
It was so long ago.
You just had to tough it out and hope that, you know, you figured it out eventually. What did you think you wanted to do when you grew up? Were you already crazed with the idea of being a movie star because you like movies so much?
No, definitely not. I loved movies and everything, but I was very, very into politics. My dad was friends with the committeeman of the 43rd Ward, a guy named Danton. And I would
his last
on election
name was Khan.
Day, I would,
that's unfortunate. His last for a politician.
Name yeah, Danton. I know. I think it was K-A-H-N.
Oh, okay.
But for
okay.
Chicago
that's better,
politicians,
yeah.
You don't want any version of the word Khan
right,
in your name.
That's true, yes.
Unless you're the actor James Caan.
That's true. Then you're case, fine.
Then you're fine. Or, for the record, Scott Caan.
The son
you know,
of
so
James
I would
Caan,
go
yes.
to, I would go to, you know, on election day, I would go to the precincts, and I would, you know, walk around and see people canvassing. I just remember being so into it. And, like, Chicago politics was always, like, dramatic, you know what I mean? Like, I remember, like, the night Harold Washington got elected, and I remember the night Harold Washington died. It was just so interesting to me, and kind of watching, you know, as a kid looking like Ronald Reagan is kind of like this funny, charismatic guy. But then, you know, Bill Clinton, politics seemed like the right thing for me. I wanted to do it. And I think I was full of it enough, you know, to think that I could do it well. And that was kind of what my goal was. But I had this problem where I just wasn't a good enough student. And then I went to college and it didn't really work out in college. And I kind of knew at that point, I didn't think I could be in politics just because I, at that point, it didn't require
above a fifth grade level of reading and writing. And
you needed to basically be like a real human being who wasn't a complete moron. But the good news is now anyone can. Literally anyone can now, which is great. That's like cool.
Yeah,
now, I guess.
I think it's really funny that your description of why you were interested in politics essentially is that you turned it into theater. You were like, it was dramatic and they were charismatic and it was exciting. Like, it was less about like,
that's
I really wanted
true.
To help the people. It was like, you were like, Jane Byrne went and lived in the projects and that was a real
people.
Cool stunt. She got a lot
the
of pub for that.
Helping people and making the world a better place is all secondary to the theater.
Well, I think you chose right then.
I think so.
We've got
I think
enough
so.
Politicians that chose for that reason. We need more than we're just trying to help the people. So you went to Boston University. Did you play sports in high school?
I did. I played basketball. Basketball, growing up in Chicago, as you know, in the 90s, it was all basketball. It was just like all anyone cared about. I'm not kidding. I think I watched every Bulls game from like 1990 to 1998.
We all did.
Yeah, basketball was big. We were in a Latin was in a small division like the ISL or something. But we had a pretty good team my sophomore and junior year. We had a couple really good guys. And then, you know, senior year, they got a new coach who just didn't like me. Mm. And I had like an injury from soccer that was lingering. And so I ended up quitting or getting thrown off of the basketball team my senior year, which was very...
I'm sure you remember which one it was.
No, I really don't. Because it was like, it was kind of one of those like... I quit, but you're going to fire me soon or vice versa.
Anyway.
I really don't remember.
Right.
I've blocked it out with more important things, which is anything. It's like the least important thing. Like in high school, you think getting cut from the team is like horrible. It literally has zero impact in your life. It will never come back. So,
unless
so
you're Michael Jordan, in which case it will inspire you to
Michael
become
Jordan,
the greatest of all time.
Yes, it could be a real motivator. But it can go either way. So that was really a basketball guy. I mean, we did other things, but like, you know, track and
soccer.
I never
clearly.
Played baseball, which I really wish I did. I ended up doing other sports instead of baseball. I don't know why, but basketball was the big sport.
So you went on to Boston University. What did you intend to study? Was it still the political leanings at that point?
It was, but I was really the last grasp, you know what I mean, of it. It was like... I got to college and like all of a sudden it was like, you're free and you could like watch movies all day and like, what's this pot? I'll try it. And so it's like, you know, you really kind of, I really just, I kind of got so caught up in the freedom of it all. And again, it was the same situation with the basketball coach where I was like, and when it came to classes at BU, I was like, I'm not going. And, like, you want me to leave, and you're sending me letters telling me I should leave, but you're not really formally kicking me out, so I'm just going to quit. You know what I mean?
Right.
The waters are very muddied, but I just knew that at that point there was no politics or, you know, that just wasn't going to happen. And my love of writing really was kind of, you know, burgeoning in my head. I had read some books that really got me into, like, I really want to be a screenwriter. Dave Stass and my partner and I, we wrote for our high school newspaper, the comedy column together. And we always had like pipe dreams as, you know, well, let's be screenwriters and let's make movies. And that was really being away from, you know, my friends and my family and watching movies all day. I kind of went crazy a little bit, but then I think out of that madness, I was like, oh yeah, no, I want to make movies.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
It's interesting how many people that are really successful, like, they're able to realize, like, their focus is not going to be used anywhere else well. And so to just get after it and like, kind of eschew the normal path, which, you know, for young people listening to the pod, maybe not the best idea unless you're preternaturally talented and likely to have that actually work out for you. Like, I had Andy Buckley on the show. I don't know if you know him.
Oh,
personally.
I love him. He's my neighbor. I love him.
No way. He is the best. He's such a nice guy.
Great.
But
guy.
He was like, yeah, you know, I went to Stanford and like golfed, but like I didn't really want to and I didn't go to class and I didn't care. And then I just was doing nothing. And I was like, oh my God, all the lessons that we're sending to the youth is like, if you just quit stuff, you'll just end up being a superstar actor. But I think if you have the talent and whatever, it works out despite maybe not being totally focused at the beginning. But that's not going to work for everybody.
No, it won't work for everybody. And I will say this is, you know, I didn't know. I knew it was one of those things where I knew what I didn't want. And I think I knew what I wanted. But I had no idea how to go about it. And after I, you know, BU and I decided we weren't going to see each other anymore. You know, I was back in Chicago. My parents wanted to actively kill me because I just
no, that was a good
them.
Use of their money. Yeah.
Oh God. I mean, seriously. Like, I think it was like, I don't. It was in the 90s, but it was like over $25,000.
Yeah.
So expensive. College is so expensive, and like they got nothing out of it. And when I say nothing, I mean like nothing.
Did you make it to the first parents' visit? Because that would be something. They got to go once.
Did they make it to? Yeah, they made it to the parents' visit, but it was under a real cloud of lies.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm doing fine. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't like. And I'm sure I was a jerk. I was like, oh, I want to go hang out with my friends. Leave me alone. You know, whatever. So I was back home, and my dad was friends with this lady who he went to law school with, named Karen Dorff. And he took me to the Improv Olympics. I think it was the 10th or the 15th anniversary, probably the 15th. And it was at the Vic Theater, and it blew me away. And I remember specifically, I mean, go looking back, it was like Adam McKay, you know, Amy Poehler and Chris Farley. But the person who, like, for some reason, he was so funny in this improv scene was Tim Meadows. He was so funny to me. Yeah. And he was, I just remember thinking like, I could do this. Like, I'm like, he's making funny jokes and funny references. I can kind of do that in conversation and people are annoyed. So maybe if I do it on stage in the guise of a character, people won't be annoyed. But I remember thinking like, oh, maybe I'll do that. So my dad, you know, was like, okay, well, if you want to take classes, you know, pay for them. And I had a job. I was working for the CTA. The transportation company.
I love that. And what were you doing for the CTA?
I was working for an offshoot of the marketing department, quality management.
Oh man, I was hoping you were in like the booth or something when someone's card isn't working. Just people screaming at you.
Well, to be honest, it's
not
so funny you said that because our department was the people who tested the prototype for the first credit card machine. This was back in 1997 maybe. So I literally had to go with these machines that weren't working yet and try to convince riders on, like, you know, the Brown Line to to like try them, and more times than not in the beginning their money would keep, but like not the card wouldn't work, and they would scream at me and they'd be like, "You're ruining my morning." I'm like, "I'm sorry." Anyway, so it was a nightmare, and but I took a ton of classes and really spent years and years taking classes and doing shows every night, and I kind of got introduced into this whole world. And I think just to what you were saying earlier is like, you need some talent, but like I think it's really about putting in those hours, and you know what I mean, and like,
yeah,
you know, the that's definitely what I have, my 10,000 hours of improv. You know what I mean, like I've spent that's what I did, that's what I come from, and it really is, I think, the kind of the backbone of everything I do today.
When you went to Amsterdam, was that before you moved to LA?
Yeah, so basically I did like 3-4 years in Chicago, and it was great. The improv scene in the 90s in Chicago was so great. There's so many amazing people there at the time, you know, and that was right before everyone started moving to LA and before SNL grabbed a bunch of people. So you just would go and you would see, you know, and I would either be performing at Improv Olympic or I would be like a busboy at Second City. And you would see like Tina Fey, Biggio, and you know, Brian Stack, and just all these like amazing, Bob Odenkirk would zip in, Chris Farley would come by, smoke a joint with him. And it was just like the greatest time to be there. It was really cool. But then I had heard about this theater in Amsterdam that they paid you to just act. You didn't have to have a job. You could just act. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And then I knew this guy, Seth Meyers, had gone there, and he was there. I was like, oh, I know Seth. That's kind of cool. You know, he went there. Then I auditioned for it, and they hired me. And I shipped off to Amsterdam
cool.
in 99.
With
and
Jordan
that was
Peele.
That was crazy.
Jordan Peele was
yeah,
in the group, right?
We basically, you know, it was this thing. It's a company called Boom Chicago. And it started off just a couple people in the back of a bar, you know, a bunch of three guys from Evanston. And then it turned into this big theater, you know, hundreds of people coming every night. And, you know, during my time there, you know, I was there with Seth and Josh Myers and Jordan Peele and Jason Sudeikis and Kay Cannon, who directed me on Blockers, and just this amazing roster of just really, really, really funny, cool people. It was a very
awesome.
Fun time to be in Amsterdam.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you feel like work is kind of paying off. You're being paid to do the job, even if it is traveling around a bunch. You moved to LA, and what was it like trying to get off the ground there? Was that an immediate Mad TV hit, or did it take a little while?
No, it took a while. It was it's like when you first moved to LA, it's like, you know, it's exciting, but it's really can be soul shattering, you know, because you're just like, you know, it's unless you come here like with a job, you know what I mean? Like just finding like a bad job is hard. Like I remember, mm-hmm. I went to Morton's and I was like, because my dad had a friend who was like he's a waiter at Morton's in Chicago, and he gave me the number, you know, and he's like, go to Morton's, tell them you're friends with me. And I went to Morton's and I was like expected to be like a waiter, and they wouldn't even hire me to be a busser. They're like, no, get out. Like,
yeah,
no,
I had to be a hostess at a restaurant because they said to be a waitress, I would need to have 5 to 7 years of waitressing experience. And I was like, I would rather move home and become something else than have to work.
Yeah, I can't. I couldn't do it. But then finally I did. Finally, they were like, okay, hey, one of our bussers quit. And I was like, sure, I'll do it. Just because I need, like, you need
yeah,
money.
You
and,
need
like,
something,
bussing,
you need
like,
flexibility.
They share tips with the waiters and stuff. So I was a busboy at Morton's over on Beverly Hills for probably a year and a half. And you know, I was living out here with Dave and Seth and Josh Myers. We weren't getting any, like, you don't get any acting work. You know what I mean? Like, you just kind of sit around in your like awful apartments that's filled with like patio furniture, and you just drink. That's really like, and you watch sports and movies and stuff. Cause there's just like, you can't afford to go out. You know what I mean? Like none of us had girlfriends. Like it was all like, yeah, we were losers. But you know, then Seth, I remember when he got SNL the first time, I was like, whoa, one of our friends is going to like be on like a cool show.
Yeah.
And then about, I think, you know, a few months later, or maybe a year later, I did a two-man show with Josh, his brother, and Mad TV at the time had just had a few cast members leave, and they were looking to kind of relaunch the show, and not relaunch the show, just restock the cast, I guess. And they came and saw us, and they're like, okay, these guys are, you know, all right, they can write. They hired us, and so after a couple rough years out there, I got really lucky and was able to get a job on Mad TV.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's really – and was there a dream for you of Saturday Night Live, especially when Seth went there? Were you ever trying to get him to get you an audition?
Oh, I mean, SNL, when you're in the – you know, improv community, like everyone's goal is always that.
Yeah.
That's the goal. And, you know, I think if I hadn't gotten Mad TV, I would have pressured Seth to try to get me an audition. But, you know, like, you can't do that to your friends, especially, like, I don't
when
know.
Brand
like,
new. Built,
like, yeah, like, it's like you're, like, fighting for your life there. You know what I mean? So, like, I would have been like, hey, man, Seth, I know you're barely on the show. Can you put in a word for me?
You know, can like, you give Lauren a ringy-ding-ding and see if...
Flip Lauren this tape of me doing a monologue in my bedroom and see if he's interested.
Right.
I got on Mad TV, and I kind of was just on there for a long time. And I think, like, once you're on Mad TV, like, you're not going to go to SNL. They're not going to hire you. You know what I mean? Like, if you're, like, a longtime person there, like, Lauren, and I think he's right to, is, I think, kind of annoyed at Mad TV or if he cares about it at all.
Right.
But, it just to me, it seems like always weird that they put it on at the same time as SNL. I never agree with that. But I was just, and I was there and I was happy, you know, enough for a while where we were, you know, we had some good, friends on that show, Nicole Parker and Jordan and Keegan. You know, we were having a fun time, and then kind of towards the end, season 4, season 5, while I was there, I was kind of like starting to get frustrated because you know what I mean? You're not getting your stuff on enough, and the show's not doing it. The show's not exactly, like, you're a young guy. I was a young, cocky kid, and I was like, this is what the show should be, and they're like, no. And I was like, oh, you know, screw you. So, again, you know, one of those situations where it was like, I was pretty unhappy, but then they were like, we're not going to renew your contract. So, was I fired? Not really, but then I quit.
This is a theme for,
Yeah, that's
make
a shame.
Make sure your
it
wife
is.
Knows about this. The idea of divorce ever comes up. You're like, make sure that we really know what's happening here.
You need to have a firm conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So then you do a bunch of spots on different shows, smaller parts in movies, Eastbound and Down. It feels like Morgan Tuker's on the Mindy Project was your next big recurring thing.
Yeah. Well, for years, and I mean years after Matt, you kind of think like you do a show for 5 years, and they're just going to kind of open their arms for you and you know, put you on a show, and that's not the case. And it was really hard to get, like getting an acting job is like impossible. It's like so hard, like to go and audition and like have to, especially for like TV for, you know, they have like pilot season where everyone's, you know, you have like, I don't know, like 100,000 people or more trying to get like the same 300 parts. So it's so hard. And I would kind of come close, but just not really, no networks were interested in me at all. Like 0%. Cause I'm like kind of, you know, like a weird, a little bit like, well, you know, I'm a little weird looking and just kind of like, not really you know what I mean? Like, I feel like TV then was like, just really like pure good looking people, like, like purebreds. You know what I mean?
I mean,
like
everybody knows when they get to Hollywood, like you're either the lead or you're the quirky best friend or you're the character actor, and you got to just be able to own your role.
And I was kind of just, I was kind of like, I think they couldn't put their finger on me, so I never got anything. It was really Danny. He was the first person. Danny McBride was the first person to kind of like hire me for something that I thought was a good show. I was a huge fan of Eastbound. And when, you know, I went in and auditioned and read with him for to play Ivan, and they hired me. That was where I was like, oh, thank God, thank you. You know,
right?
Like,
I needed this.
Finally, I'm on like a show that I like. And, like, this is awesome. And I think really from that, Mindy was the next person to really kind of be like, I want to work with you. And that was a case of just Dave Stassen and I were kind of like at this point where I was like, we have to write something, but I want to act. And usually when you write on a when you staff on a TV show, that's just a full-time job, and it's very hard to act on anything else. You know, you can't really turn to your boss and in the writer's room and be like, I have an audition in an hour in Santa Monica. I'm going to go. They'll be like, no.
Just wrap up this epi without me. Yeah.
Yeah. So we, you know, luckily got set up with Mindy, and we saw her pilot, which we thought was great. We were huge, huge fans of The Office, huge fans of her. And she was kind of like, maybe like you can be on the show too. We'll maybe find like a part. And I thought she was kind of just paying me lip service. But then after spending a few weeks in the writer's room, she really kind of started, I think, fleshing out the idea of the concept of this character, Morgan. And then she just came to me and was like, hey, I'm going to just tell the network that just to make you play this part. She's like, she came from The Office, and Greg Daniels on The Office was very fond of writer performers like her, BJ Novak. I think he likes that. And I think she likes that. And she wanted to kind of continue that tradition on her show. And you know, God bless her that she didn't make me audition for it. The network just was cool. And they were like, okay, fine. You know what I mean? It really took like a strong woman to come in and be like, listen, just put this guy on TV for God's sake.
I believe in him. It'll work. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I think just to kind of the nature of the character and the difference between him and Mindy made for a very funny pairing. And it was just a very natural kind of well for the writers to dip into.
Well, that is legit one of my favorite shows of all time. And if people have not seen it, it's on Hulu and you can watch every single season. One of the funny things about that show is so when I was in LA, I remember I took this class, this guy, Scott Sedita, did a class that was like the 8 characters of comedy. And so you're supposed to know in every sitcom that they were falling usually under these things and help you make choices in your auditions. And when you watch that show, half of the cast is in your own universe, which is supposed to be one person. It's like the example you use is like Phoebe in Friends. Like everybody else is like neurotic or logical or dumb. There's only one that's allowed to just say stuff that doesn't make any sense and isn't rooted in anything and can change the next moment.
Right.
But like Beverly, Morgan, occasionally
Colette.
Tamara, like Colette, like they're all in your own universe, and yet somehow it doesn't frustrate the viewer. You're not like, wait, that's different than what they just, it's hilarious because of that. That takes some real incredible writing to like keep that through line despite all of that weirdness.
Yeah. I mean, she really, she's so great, Mindy. She puts such a premium on writing, and she kind of really assembled a team of people, very, very, you know, kind of just diverse in terms of like what they offer group. And I think really by the time that second season came along, really once, you know, we were on our feet and we had what I consider to be kind of the heart of the staff, once we're like Tracy Wigfield and Lang Fisher from 30 Rock came on board, and Jack Burdett, we just kind of started finding those moments more enjoyable, and we found that we could get away with it. And as long as we're, you know, keeping the scenes on story and the stories are working, you're allowed to have those characters kind of have those little brief glimpses into their usually, terrifying lives. Like Beverly is like a psycho.
She's
like, I mean,
a psycho.
Not even
when
a psychopath. She's
like stealing
a murderer
from her son that she like abandoned. And yeah, she is a murderer. Like,
I wanted to make a
but
super
she's
cut
old.
Of like all
she's
like,
fine.
She's old. I wanted to make all the super cuts of all the like relationships she's
in. Oh, for
in,
sure.
Like Robert Durst and Charles Manson and in the writer's room, we would think she's crazy. Like she killed 200 people to dining hall in Miami. Like, she's just insane. So she was very fun to write for.
Yeah. So is it different at all working for Mindy? I'm sure it's not the – you at this point have worked with, like, every woman I'm obsessed with, which we'll get to in a minute. But, you know, there's so much conversation about Mindy being special and that she was starring and directing and writing. And as you already mentioned, that's really tough to do. But does it actually feel any different on set?
On set, when you're doing all that?
When it's a woman who's in that big boss lady role versus a lot of shows which tend to have male, you know, men in all those roles.
Yeah, I mean, it's better. for the record, there's only a couple people that I can think of who do that, and I'm just trying to think, like, I think most of them are, like, women, and I mean, like, Mindy, Tina, Lena, you know what I mean? Like, they're all, I think more and more people are doing it. I saw, like, Bill Hader's new show last night, which is really funny. I mean, like, he think he's doing that where I think he's writing and, like, directing and acting and stuff. I think it's probably, it's case by case, but what I learned from Mindy and what I know from Tina is you just want to be working with the A students. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You want to be working with, I'm not an A student. Like, I'm like, yeah. Like, I got some B's, but I remember thinking,
you're
like,
a dropout. Ike, you're a dropout.
I'm a dropout. I'm a college dropout. Like Kanye West.
Just like Kanye. Because you're really similar, actually.
I've been saying that for a long time, but you just want to attach yourself to an A student. And someone that has the drive and the skills and the personality. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of the three things you want. You want someone who, A, can do the job well. You know what I mean? You don't want the show to get canceled. And then you just want, like Tina in her book makes such a good point. She's like, you don't want to hire anyone you would not want to, like, bump into in the hallway at midnight. You know what I mean? And
yes.
You know what I mean? And, like, so you want to just be cool and fun and make people feel excited to be there. And that was something Mindy did so well, which, you know, she recognized that the hours were long and, you know, sometimes it's not like glamorous, but like, you know, treat everyone great and let's have some food trucks. You know what I mean? And like, like make people, like, let's have a kick-ass party when we wrap, you know what I mean? Like, and I think just kind of having that personality, just, it makes the job easier for sure because people are in a better mood, but also makes the work better. I think people, you know, want to work harder for someone that they, you know, they feel like a kinship with and they love. And I think that's the other kind of main component you want from your number one.
So you mentioned Tina. Obviously, you worked with Tina and Amy, Mindy, Amy Schumer, Garfunkel and Oates, like all these very strong women who are obviously incredible performers, but also like badass boss ladies. Why do you think, is there something about you that you think particularly appeals to them when they're looking to fill their casts and work with people?
I don't know. A part of it is once you work with someone, you get along with someone, you know, everyone knows everyone and people always call and check and be like, hey, is this person a serial killer? And I
so
think
on a scale
if,
of one
you know,
to 10,
like,
how pervy is Ike?
Yeah. And I know they would say, you know, 3,
sometimes 4.
Fine, I think, no. But I think like, you know, I had known Tina and Amy for a long time, and just because I knew Tina when she was like, you know, the star of the Second City show, and I was making frozen pizzas in the back for the customer.
Right.
So just by kind of knowing someone for a long time, there's already a comfortability there. And Amy too. Amy taught me improv at the I.O. in 1996. You know what I mean? So like,
it's amazing.
I think once you kind of work with people who know each other, they know that A, they see the work and they're like, oh, that's funny. You know what I mean? Like I see their, you know, how this could be funny in my story. And then just by kind of knowing that, oh, he's like a not a scumbag. You know what I mean? He's not a scumbag and works hard. Like, that's all I can ask for on my tombstone. He wasn't a scumbag and he worked hard.
All right, speaking of working hard, during your movie that's about to come out, Blockers, you were doing your own stunts for some reason and you, like, broke your neck.
Yeah.
Explain this to me.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about it, though, because it's
okay.
Just a bummer.
Like, legally?
So.
Oh, okay. It's
I just don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah,
okay?
No, it's cool. I'm on the mend, feeling better. I just don't even want to talk about it.
Okay. Can we talk about the movie? Yeah. That's not a bummer.
Yes.
It looks
the
really
movie
funny.
It's as not funny as it is breaking your neck. That's how funny the movie is.
Wow. Okay. So it's going to be a huge success because breaking your neck sucks. From the trailers,
exactly.
It looks amazing. What would you compare it to in terms of, like, because it feels like based on the name already, Blockers, which of course is short for Blockers. I don't know if that's going to get bumped. I'm pretty sure it's going to get bleeped.
Yeah,
out,
I don't know. I don't know. I keep wondering about
that. Disney company here at ESPN.
Like,
so.
Yeah. My nightmare is that people are like, why is there a rooster? And then I'd be like, because it's a
Yeah. You know what? So my mom doesn't know anything about bad things. She's a very sweet lady. She's not, like, dumb. She's just naive about sexual stuff. So we try to teach her new words. And one year we taught her block and we made her use it in a sentence. And so she was, like, talking about planet Earth and how this plant was blocking this insect from getting what it wanted. And we were like, yay. So I feel like some people just don't know words like that. As much as it seems normal to us. Yeah.
I know. And you know she's going to misuse it. She's going to be
the
supermarket.
Sure.
And like, she's going to be reaching for a box of cereal, and they're going to take it. She's like, don't block me. And they're like, ma'am, please leave.
I would die. But yeah, so some people don't know. It's not as obvious than people who have, you know, a sailor's mouth like we do. But based on the name, it seems like it's going to be a pretty raucous comedy, a little bit, you know, blue.
It's blue. Yeah, it's definitely blue. I mean, this is a movie that it was brought to my attention a couple years ago, and I'd heard about it, and I remember reading, like, oh, yeah, they're like three dads, and their sons are, like, you know what I mean? And I didn't think much about it, but then they kind of reworked it, right? And I'd worked with Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg on the Neighbors movies and a couple other things here and there, and they were like, hey, Kay Cannon is going to direct it, and I've known Kay for a very long time. And we did Boom Chicago together. We just did always loved each other and always just said that, you know, let's work together one day, that phony LA thing. We should work together.
Yeah.
And, you know, she, you know, I talked to her on the phone and she kind of talked me through kind of her vision of the film and kind of how she saw it. And her pitch of just like how she's making them, you know, the kind of one of the parents, a mom now. So it's not just like three dads assessing about their daughter's, you know, virginity, which can kind of be weird. And just kind of the way she was talking about it. I was like, yeah, I get that. Like that makes sense. And it's funny. And then once she was like, hey, I think, you know, we're going to make John Cena and Leslie Mann the other parents. I was like, hey, great. Like now I'm in. I was in beforehand, but when she told me that, I was like, let's do it. Like, let's get it going.
And
because
you, did you get to work with John at all in Sisters, or were you guys all in separate,
We did, like, one day together. And
he's hilarious.
We're like, didn't get a chance to, like, hang it all. But I remember thinking, a nice guy, cool guy. When I saw Trainwreck, I was like, he's really funny.
Yeah.
And I've been a huge fan of Leslie Mann's forever.
Oh, yeah,
and,
she's
like,
unreal.
I think she is such an amazing comedic actor. And so I was like, okay, great. And then, you know, there was just like script work, but then we got to Atlanta last summer and, you know, we shot a lot of stuff and you just never know. You never know how it's going to turn out. And I feel like, you know, I think Trump got elected and there was, you know, another interesting layer to the story. And then the Me Too movement kind of happened. I was wondering, like, wow, I wonder how this is going to kind of play because it does make sense, you know, in terms of female empowerment and the message of the movie. It seems to be laying out nice. And it turned out, it just turns out that people who have seen it are kind of walking out and they're like, I thought it was just going to be like a straight up nonstop laughs with like a very subtle message, but people are really like connecting with like the themes of the movie. And the reality is we've seen stories like this before, right? We've seen Superbad,
right.
You know, we've seen those movies about
American Pie.
American Pie, exactly, but teenagers and sex. But it's always kind of the same thing. It's always kind of the same POV. And now to kind of show, you know, these young women who are hilarious in it and kind of their point of views about it. And then you make the parents, right, these kind of idiots who are holding on to the last vestiges of,
right,
like, their baby boomers' parents' attitudes towards sex. You get a lot of comedy and heart out of it. So it's I've been so happy with the reaction so far. And, you know, I can tell you this. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on in the world right now. You will go to the theater, and for 95 minutes, I promise you, you will laugh very hard.
Awesome. I'm super excited.
That's
it comes out on April 6th.
Guarantee.
It was a good sell job by you, too. You've really been hitting You've been doing your work on these promo tours here. Yes, April 6th. You mentioned Trump. I just saw a quote from you just did that hilarity for charity on Sunday. It doesn't come out until a couple weeks, I think. But you mentioned that it was like almost impossible to avoid the Trump jokes. You talk about politics a lot on social media, so obviously still invested in it, even though you have no aspirations as of now to get back into the political realm. Do you feel like Hollywood's sort of a safe space for that, where you're not really concerned if people disagree with you? Because, like, in my industry, there's been a lot of conversation about trying to keep it out of sports because they don't want to alienate people. It feels like Hollywood might be an easier place to be a liberal.
Well, I think people in show business typically are more liberal because the reality is, and I'm not trying to be a jerk here, but the reality is I think you, when you're in show business, you're just, you see all kinds of people. It's the opposite of a homogeneous environment. And I think, quite frankly, performers, actors, and writers are required to draw from a lot more empathy. And I think that's something that you don't see on the other side. And it's very sad to me that you don't. So it makes sense that, you know, people in this business are looking at kind of what's going on, being like, oh, this is not right. This feels wrong. You know, I'm surprised. Surprised that there's not more kind of people standing up. I think, you know, obviously, you know, I think we're still, a lot of people are programmed, you know, MJ's old quote of Republicans got to buy sneakers too.
Right.
I don't think
that's
valid
anymore.
Which
he claims he never actually said, but I'm sure it was stemmed from a vibe, at least, if nothing else, if not the actual
words. Yeah. Yes. For the record, I didn't even know he said he didn't say that. But, like, I think what's happening now is just, quite frankly, too important. And, you know, my theory is like, if there might be some people who are afraid to say things because they don't want to alienate their base. And I understand that, and I do respect it. But I think what's happening right now is too important. And quite frankly, I talked to a friend of mine. I said, God, you know, are you worried that, you know, someone might say you tweet about Trump too much? And I said, if they knew what I truly thought was going to happen, they would want me to tweet more. So, you know, like,
right.
me, it's like, we're living in such insane times. And, you know, if you have a platform and you're so inclined, I say, use it, and make jokes or keep people aware, or don't. It's America. It's your right to do either. But I think we're definitely on the precipice of something pretty abnormal and messed up. So I think I feel a definite duty to say something.
Duty. Also, I wanted to ask about this movie, The Oath, that I saw. So you're writing, producing, directing, and it's a satirical thriller. So is this your Jordan Peele moment? Are you basically ripping off your old buddy? It's Get Out 2, but it's just from the white perspective, which was not understood
I did not rip him off. This is about a Jewish man going to his Christian girlfriend's house, and the father is a magician.
Oh, wow. This sounds special.
This is, I think that people mentioned Get Out in the same breath because it was the same producer, this company called QC. But this is a movie that I wrote right after the election, and just kind of at first thought it was, oh, this is a funny look at a dystopian future. But now every day we're like, okay, this is happening. But it's really more just, it's really about kind of how we act with our families around the holidays. And the backdrop of it is that there's kind of crazy things happening, but I don't know about you, my immediate family is, we're all pretty, snowflake lib cucks, but my extended family is certainly not. My family in South Central Ohio, the Ohio Valley, are not. And I think a lot of people in this country have a lot of stress when they go, because they have this thing where they love their relatives, but you don't want to get in a fight with them.
Right. So it's sort of about holiday, that going home for Thanksgiving. Yeah, sort of going home for Thanksgiving.
It's literally,
It's
literally about a family at Thanksgiving.
Okay,
We shot it, and Tiffany Haddish and I are just like, we're husband and wife.
Oh, my God, it's
trying
with Tiffany Haddish.
It.
Stop hanging out with all the best women.
I'm going to
single white female you.
You can do that. But she plays my wife, and we're just trying to, like, navigate the week of Thanksgiving with all this crazy stuff going on.
Amazing.
And the movie gets so crazy and weird and kind of dark, but it was really – really fun to make it, and we're hoping that it kind of comes out this fall. We're hoping.
Awesome. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right, well, before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That is true. It's the Spanish Inquisition. It's the same questions that everybody asks, but somehow nobody expects, because apparently none of my guests listen to my podcast before they come on. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Oh, the natural talent? Ooh,
yes.
Being able to throw a baseball fast.
Nice. Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Desert Island album. I'm going to have to go Chicago and say the soundtrack to High Fidelity.
Wow. Nice. Nice. Yeah. Very good. Number three, if you could switch lives with someone for a day, who would it be?
Wow. Someone for a day. I'm not just saying this because we're from Chicago, but God, it would be fun to be Anthony Rizzo for a minute.
Oh, yeah. He's doing all right for himself. Yeah. That's
yeah.
A good one.
And he
that's
literally looks like he's always having fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love him.
You see the new MLB video game? It's like the MLB 18 or whatever. It's actually programmed in. If you hit a home run as a Cub, then it flashes to the bullpen dancing.
Oh.
It's amazing.
I don't believe in jinxes and stuff. I think they're going to win the World Series this year.
I'm sorry.
I feel like
I don't believe in jinxes. Yeah.
I don't believe in jinxes. I feel like they're kind of like the Blackhawks. We're like, yeah, they win the World Series, and then they come close.
They take a year off,
and they win
and then
it
they
again.
Come back. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. Let's do it. I agree.
Let's do it.
Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
The most scared I've ever been. Wow, that is a really good question. I remember I went to Israel once, and it was during the Gulf War, and they gave me like a needle, and they said, if you see yellow gas, jab this needle in your leg.
Oh,
I was like, what?
God.
I was like,
what?
12. I was like, okay.
What? Why were you there?
I just went. I was like 14. I went to Israel for the summer on like some program, and it was like right around
like
the
one
Gulf
of those,
War.
Like where a bunch of Jewish kids
the Masada or something.
Got it.
Yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's terrifying. That's
it
a good
was really
one.
Scary.
I have not heard that one before. Number five, what would you consider your biggest failure?
My biggest failure. Wow. Oof. I had kind of like a, not a fight, but just kind of like a passive aggressive conversation with my wife about how I can't bake anything. And to prove her wrong, I told her I could bake chocolate chip cookies that were just as good as hers. And they sucked. They were like the worst. They were like, it was,
but you were really trying your best.
I was trying so hard. And I just sucked at it. And I'm just saying, I'm sure I've had bigger ones
that stands out.
Calamitous, but this is fresh in my mind, and I'm still kind of bummed out, to be honest.
And honestly, like, being proven wrong by your spouse is the most, it will stand out more in your mind than a true failure.
It really does.
It will come up for the rest of your life.
It's also not like I had to like bench press 1,000 pounds. I had to make it a goddamn chocolate chip cookie.
Oh man. Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Habit or quality? Annoying persistence.
Oh, that's good. I like that. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
I wish I was faster.
At doing things? Or running?
No. I wish I didn't get so tired at like 9:30 at night. I would love to be able to like be fully awake until 10:30, but by 9:30, my eyes are flickering.
How old are your children?
Again, that's very lame and mundane, but it's the
right.
Fresh in my head.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
5 and 2.
That might be part of that. Yeah.
That's a big part of it. It's just getting them down is like an Olympic event.
Number eight, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Handsome, comma, perfect ass.
Oh, good. I have not gotten that one either.
There you go.
And finally, the bonus question, who would you recommend that I invite onto this podcast?
Oh, that's good. I mean, I would say Dave Stassen, but he could be like a backup if someone maybe more famous.
Like if I can't get someone canceled. Good. Like on a week that I'm just really stuck.
I'm trying to think who would be a good guest for your podcast. I'm gonna say Tiffany Haddish.
Oh, well, I mean,
she's an amazing guest.
Hook it up, dude. Hey, let me know when she needs to promote that movie and then tell her that I will be the number one stop for best spot to promote the movie.
I'm sorry,
Vanity Fair called.
Sure.
They'll have to wait.
They have to wait. They're going to wait.
Perfect. Ike, you're the best. Thank you so much. I love chatting with you.
No,
we'll have to do it again sometime.
So
that's what she said.
This week's That's What She Read is actually a two-parter. The first part is That's What She Heard. And someone on Twitter sent me this great podcast called The Second Captain's Podcast out of Ireland. It features a former Irish footballer, some journalists, a couple other folks. And this particular episode 1124, it's called The Belfast Rape Trial, Sexual Consent, and a Toxic Dressing Room Culture, was such an interesting listen. It was really wide-ranging. It started out talking about the issue of rape and assault in pertaining to an athlete out there and how it had been received by the public when the announcement was made that charges were dropped, and then tackled all sorts of other stuff from sexual consent to pornography in youth, entitlement in pro sports, you know, the former footballer talking about his agency and how when he was trying to figure out who would represent him, one of the agencies described was that basically they had such good relationships with the local media that if he ever did anything wrong, they would be able to float profiles of higher level folks to try to bury it and kind of like a give and take and make sure that he never got found out for all the bad things that he might do. It was just a really frank and really smart and really well researched conversation. And I don't know, it also kind of was interesting to me that everyone was from Ireland and their perspective being somewhat different from ours and yet the same issues. So I really recommend it. It's called The Second Captain's Podcast, and it's episode 1124. If you search for it online, it should come up, and it's a free listen. The other That's What She Read for this week is a little bit old now, but I really wanted to share it because I thought it was such a great story, and too often these are very thoughtful but not super positive stories. It's a silver lining kind of story. A man who was wrongfully convicted spent 23 years in prison. This is the bad part, but the silver lining. He worked with the White Sox before he was sent to jail. And what he said during his time in prison was, if I ever get out of here, I would like my job back with the White Sox. So he was a 25-year-old groundskeeper, was convicted of a rape and murder, sentenced to life in prison without parole. Then he was freed last year after DNA was linked to a serial rapist. He's out of prison, and friends and family reached out to the White Sox after his release, and the White Sox, did an interview check back in with him and said they were happy to welcome him back to the team. And so, you know, two of his friends that are still on the grounds crew from there, you know, are there to greet him and welcome him back. And it's really just a really cool story. And there's a little video that goes along with it too. You can find it on CNN. It was everywhere, but this particular story on CNN. The headline is "Wrongfully Convicted Man Gets Job Back with the White Sox After 23 Years in Prison" by David Williams. So a little feel-good story for today. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.